In good faith, filed a claim under the workers' compensation statute. What happens when the individual has a third-party claim and subsequently the third party retaliates by saying to it that his employer terminates him? That is, in essence, the case that we have before you. I represented Mr. Sterner. In fact, the case indicates that Mr. Sterner had a case against Marathon. If that case went to trial, he was successful on the case, recovered a judgment of $25,000. The case went to the Court of Appeals, and while the case was on appeal to the Texas Supreme Court, he went out to work for a subcontractor, or an independent contractor, Ford, Bacon, and Davis, at the Marathon plant. Marathon's safety representative, who happened to sit in at the trial, saw him out there, asked him what he was doing out there. When he responded that I'm working, the Marathon representative said, not if I have anything to do about it. And sure enough, the next morning, when Mr. Sterner showed up for work, he received a pink slip. That pink slip is Exhibit 1. And under the reasons listed for termination, it said per Marathon directive. And I think that's important in the case because there were any number of reasons that could have been listed, such as absenteeism, failure to perform work adequately, insubordination.
Are you saying he was guilty of all those, or those were?
Those were options.
Options under a union contract, or options on the form itself?
Just general options, Your Honor, not on the form. But I'm saying of all the reasons that could have been listed, those were not listed. And that's important because of what their allegations are for the reason for his termination.
There is a good bit of indication in the Court of Appeals opinion about his physical limitations arising from the incident that gave rise to his first lawsuit. I gather that none of those were a factor at all. There was never any suggestion that he was physically unable to do the particular work he was assigned on this job.
That was a disputed fact issue in this case, and is an important issue, Your Honor, because it's a credibility problem. My client said, I was out there, had a job working on the ground, was performing my job adequately. And the man who fired him, or let him go, the job superintendent, Johnny Burks, said, if Mr. Sterner had been unable to do his job, I would have heard about it. And if that had been the reason for firing him, I would have put that on the termination slip. And quite frankly, it's our position that the physical limitation allegation came up later as an excuse by Marathon to cover up or explain why they went to Ford, Bacon, and Davis to get him fired.
I understand that was an issue that Marathon raised, but was it ever raised anywhere by the employer?
No, sir. And in fact, I mean, it's not only not raised, if you will look at the very short testimony of Johnny Burks, the one person in this case that had no interest, he goes beyond that and says, if it was a factor, I would have known about it, and that would have been the reason for letting him go.
The Court of Appeals reversed for no evidence. Is that correct, counsel?
Yes, sir.
And acting without justification or excuse, is that an element of the plaintiff's claim on which it has the burden?
Yes and no.
All right. What's your position on that?
The important case on this matter is the Sackowitz case. In that case, there are five justices say that there are two elements to the plaintiff's case. Number one, that the defendant maliciously interfered with a contractual relationship, and number two, that it was without legal justification or excuse. There is a well-written dissent in there by Justice Wallace, joined in by Justice Ray and Campbell, saying that really you have four elements. You have contract subject interference, you have act was willful and intentional, number three, that the act was the proximate cause of damage, and number four, that actual damage or loss occurred. And Justice Wallace says that the privilege or excuse is an affirmative defense. It's by way of avoidance. The defendant is conceding, I did all of these things, but I was privileged or had an excuse, and that is in the nature of an affirmative defense. I quite frankly agree that that would be the better approach to it. However, I do concede that it was the majority opinion that we went to trial on in the Sackwitz case, and as such, the plaintiff had the burden to prove an absence of something.
Does that mean that you have to negate a good justification or excuse, or that you have to prove that they acted from a unjustified or unexcused position?
It means your first suggestion, this is why I have problems with it. It means I have to prove the absence of something on their part. And it's not that I have to prove that they acted with malice. I'm supposed to prove that they acted without a bad intent. But even given that...
Without a good intent.
Sir?
Without a good intent. You're supposed to prove they acted without a good intent.
Without bad intent.
All right.
And if you don't prove that, you win? I mean... Awesome.
I lose. However, the problem in this particular case, and becomes a technical point, I submitted the special issue as such. Do you find, from a preponderance of the evidence, that in essence Marathon acted without legal justification or excuse? Which is, I think, the way, I don't agree with it, but the way I believe it should have been submitted under the majority opinion of Sackwitz. However, the defendants insisted upon submitting the issue their way, which said, in essence, do you find from the preponderance of the evidence that they acted with malice? In other words, they converted it from an element of my case to an affirmative defense. They switched it from my burden of proof to prove without malice to their burden of proof to prove that they acted with excuse. That's going to be important on the no evidence point, because if the special issue had been submitted with the burden of proof on me and the court had found no evidence, I would agree that the rendition of the judgment against me would be proper. But as such, when they took on the burden of proof and the court finds no evidence, that simply means that they didn't, that the court did not find evidence to support their special issue. And as such, it should not have been rendered. There are two cases in there that I think are very important. One is CNR Transport versus Campbell, which is a case from this court where this court, it involved a special issue on a truck driver. This court said it was improper to treat a negative issue by a jury to a special issue of whether, in this case, the pickup driver had driven from the shoulder onto the highway immediately prior to the accident, as a finding by the jury that the truck driver did not so drive. In other words, just because you don't carry your burden of proof does not establish the opposite proposition. In order to do what the Court of Appeals did in this case, they almost have to find that the opposite was established as a matter of law, namely that Marathon proved as a matter of law that they acted with legal justification or excuse, which kind of ties into really the third issue. Ties into the issue that Justice Stoddard brought up about these injuries. The burden of the defendant in this particular case, or if I take it on, is not just the existence of a legal justification or excuse, but that there was a bona fide exercise, or that was the reason for acting, the motivation. So even though they might have been permitted under the law to go to Mr. Sterner's employer and say, this man has physical limitations. We think he is a hazard out here, and we want him removed from this particular type of work. Even though they might have been able to do that under the law, the fact of the matter is they didn't convince the jury that that's what they were doing. In this particular case, there was strong evidence that they didn't consult the man's employer, that he wasn't having problems doing his work, and in fact, the opposite proposition was probably established in that they were getting back at him for having a successful judgment against him in the prior case. The jury could have gone either way, is what I'm saying on this matter. But what happened is they had a burden of proof, and they didn't persuade the jury. But the problem comes about when the Court of Appeals said there's no evidence to support, in essence, what became an affirmative defense issue. Our position is quite simply that there was the evidence in this case from an unbiased witness named Johnny Burks that Mr. Sterner was barred from going on the premises at any time for any reason. The issue of blacklisting came up. And the reason it came up was because that was Mr. Burks' terminology. He said Mr. Sterner, in essence, was blacklisted from entry on this plant.
Couldn't Marathon do that?
No, sir.
Aren't they entitled to say, nope, so-and-so can't come on our property?
I think that it comes about as to why they are saying that. Again, it gets back to the bona fide exercise of a legal right.
Well, suppose two people have a disagreement and one says, I just don't want you coming over here anymore. Is there any problem with that? Won't let somebody else on the private property?
That's a question that I've asked myself, and it has bothered me, because when you put it in that type of example, where you have a homeowner saying, I don't want this person on my property, it does have a certain appeal. The problem is, to take that analogy further, suppose, however, it's an air conditioning man that's going to come on your property and he has a helper with him. And instead of saying, I don't want this helper on my property because I'm afraid he'll steal my jewelry or something, you go to him and say, if you want this job, you're going to have to fire him.
That's different.
Yes, sir. And I say that's what happened in this case. I think you can leave it to the jury and to distinguish what the motivation is. Are you interfering in a bona fide exercise of a legal justification or excuse, or are you retaliating?
So if Marathon had gone to Ford, Bacon, and Davis and said, we don't want Sterner on our property, that would not have been a problem in your view, but when they went further and said, and besides that, we want you to fire him, that's where the problem arises in your position.
Yes, sir.
The record reflects that Mr. Sterner worked the first day, but the second day he became ill, and it's while he was leaving after becoming ill that he met the representative of Marathon. Is there any evidence on the record that Marathon knew that he had become ill on the job the second day?
There's no evidence in the record. You have correctly stated it to the point that he was leaving early, and that's when he encountered the safety man. And the safety man said, what are you doing? He said, I'm working. But beyond that, that's it. There's no indication the safety man even knew he was going home at that time in the record.
He was going home because he was ill. Is that correct?
That is correct. In the record, yes,
sir. Back to Justice Hedick's question, what's the difference in saying I don't want this man on my property or I want you to fire him? The work that he's doing requires him to come on the property, and the subcontractor, whoever it was, has to get that work done, and you say, I don't want this man doing it, aren't you in effect coming to fire him anyway? Even if you just say, don't want him on the property, isn't that...
It's probably a better way of doing it. It's a little bit like getting back to my opening statement, in that there, quite frankly, as a practical matter, are probably a lot of workers' compensation claimants who are let go because of filing a claim. But the employer does not say so. He says you've been absent, you've been insubordinate, or things like that. Those are legally accepted excuses for letting the man go. If, however, the reason he let him go is because he filed the claim, that is not legally acceptable. And we leave it to the jury on those type of cases to distinguish what the motivation was, to distinguish whether he was filing him for insubordination or firing him for absenteeism as opposed to filing him for the claim. I mean, this is the problem, and that it's a subjective intent type decision. I don't see what the difference would be in permitting a jury to decide whether they were having him off the premises because of a hazard or safety or protection of the employees, or whether they're getting him back.
But if someone is working for me on my property and he gets injured and he sues me, it's not a comp claim, he just sues me for negligence and he wins, and as a result of that, a good deal of personal animosity develops, and I say to him, I don't want you on my property anymore. Aren't I entitled to do that, even if the reason I don't want him to do it is because he sued me and won? Or not?
I see, and I'm hoping the court recognizes that issue is not, I mean, even though that's the general issue that may be here, the facts of this case were not that they didn't tell him they didn't want him on the property. The testimony is that they had him fired.
They said, well, they had him on a list. He was on a list of 10 other people or 12
yes.
other people.
Yes, sir.
They just failed to communicate that he was on the blacklist. Had they communicated that he was on the blacklist with him, I think the result would have been different, perhaps.
Well, if, had they communicated that he was on the blacklist, he probably would have not have been out there, which is going to get to the reason again. Would there not be a prevailing balancing in that you say if the person cannot come on your property, it really gets down to the point of is blacklisting acceptable? Can Marathon's insurance company say to Marathon, we've run through SWIB, Southwest Index Bureau, these names, and these people have three claims or more, and we want to see to it that you don't let any of these people come on the premises through any of the subcontractors. I mean, it gets down to that, I guess, a legally protectable right.
Why is it not a legally protected right when there are a few people who are professional claimants, the laborers, you know, and they go from job to job and try and back on? And that makes sense to you. You don't dispute that, do you?
I don't dispute the existence of those people, Your Honor.
So then I do dispute
Marathon making that decision about those people before they even, I mean, if they're out.
Shouldn't they be, an employer, be able to make that type of an inquiry to filter out the labor?
The employer or the third party?
Well, I mean, you would say an employer could hire or not hire anybody he wanted to on the basis of past comp claims. We're not talking about somebody that's already there, but a new applicant. It's a little far afield, but we then get to the Marathon case as the next question.
Sure.
The
employer can always refuse to hire anybody.
Yes, sir. He can refuse to hire him, and again, I guess that gets back to proving why he failed to hire him.
But you're saying it's an interference then with the third party. Marathon wouldn't have hired this guy. That's fairly obvious. But it's an interference if they keep somebody else from hiring him or cause somebody else to fire him.
Yes, I'm saying it's a wrongful interference. If what they do is in retaliation, say you're firing him.
People go to stores and apply for credit all the time, and they're often refused if they have a bad prior credit history. Would it not be very similar to not want someone on your premises who has a bad prior accident record?
I can understand the concern, but I think there's a more weighty prevailing interest in letting somebody work. If in fact that person simply has been injured before and is not of the ilk where he is making a living off of filing the claims.
I get, do you really need to take on the blacklisting issue in this case, or don't you have a narrower position, and that is that there's evidence in this case that Marathon directed another man's employer to fire. Well, that's not blacklisting, that's interference with contract.
Yes, sir.
Are you satisfied with that position, or do you...
No, I'm satisfied with even a narrower issue in that on the special issue, they took on the burden of proof. The blacklisting, you're right. I've been leery of the blacklisting issue from the beginning of this case. Not to establish precedent, but it was in there to show that it was not the reason why they were going to the employer and telling them to get rid of it. It was a retaliation.
Sackowitz was a summary judgment case.
Yes, sir.
Is there any way that case could be read as allocating burdens only for summary judgment and not once the case goes to the finder of fact?
When you read the majority opinion and you read the dissent by Justice Wallace, it does show that there was a discussion within the court
as to the
burden of proof. Because
you think that Bethlehem versus Beaumont, Beaumont versus Smith and Bethlehem versus Times Herald in any way have modified its calculation state?
If it has, I am not familiar with the application of those cases to this one, Your Honor.
It would state of mind, and getting a state of mind. And so, arguably, that case being a summary judgment case, and the inquiry being whether or not a fact issue was there was a genuine fact issue, did not apportion the burden of proof as to who had the burden to show justification.
Okay. I really think that the better delineation is the 1, 2, 3, 4 elements listed in the dissent, because we did have problems preparing the special issues in this case, trying to take on the burden of proof of negating an absence of mind, state of mind. Obviously, the court has read and is familiar with the fact. The final issue is whether, on the first element, there's a contract subject to interference. Cross point has been that a contract which is terminable at will is not provided protection. Our position is that it is provided protection, but that goes to the issue of damages. In that connection,
you're asking something very narrow here. I gather this court in the last few years has greatly opened up the ability of an employee to change employers, at least insofar as restrictive covenants are concerned.
Really has.
And one wonders how much that affects the ability of an employer to try to lure employees away. But you're not asking for anything that would affect that free right of an employer to try to hire Sterner away.
No, sir. And if anything, in reading those cases, I guess I saw in it kind of a pervasive trend that the court was supporting the idea of permitting people to work, that the restrictive covenants went against the overall public policy of encouraging people to work. We were trying to put as few restraints on that as possible, and I see somebody being prevented from starting to work because he had a claim is going against that general trend, quite frankly. I've thought of those cases in connection with this one.
Well, we said, same being violent, that a man has a right to exercise his prerogative to follow the law.
Well, Sabine Pilot is another good case, which ties into this one. Because again, in that case, a man was terminated. Why was he terminated? If the employer had simply terminated him, saying the job's over or you've done your duty up the river, probably there would have been no cause of action. But in that case, the employee proved that he was terminated because he would not do a wrongful act. He would not, I think it was, dump bilge or whatever into the channel. In other words, the same act, terminating him, on one instance it can be perfectly acceptable, but on the other hand, it is not acceptable. And again, we're encouraging the overall free enterprise system.
You can terminate a man if you don't terminate him for the wrong reason.
Sure, and most smart employers do that. I mean, they're just going to let him go. But in this case, a third party got caught actually saying, you know, I want him fired for this reason. And that's what I think, that's why I think this case is narrowly, this is why I took the case on to begin with, as opposed to somebody just complaining that he thought that might have been the reason. Here there was actually some tangible evidence, a pink slip, that said the reason for termination was per Marathon directive. As far as the terminable at will, there's a case, Evans versus McKay, 212 Southwest 1st, 680, in which, by virtue of a libel action, somebody was released and they were on a month-to-month contract. That was a Dallas case, that's a 1919 case, but the court in that case said that goes to damages. Prosser, when talking about tortious interference with a contract, his first edition, section 129, says again, the majority of jurisdictions say that goes to damages, not to the existence of a cause of action. And finally, if you look at the restatement of torts, section 766G, it speaks specifically about contracts which are terminable, saying these again are contracts that can be interfered with, and the fact that they are terminable at will goes to damages, not to the existence of the cause of action. That's our position in this case, is that terminable at will is still a contract.
Is there some difference? I didn't state my earlier question clearly. Is there a distinction between a third party interfering with the employer's desire to employ someone and a third party interfering with the employee? That is, if, let's get away from that. Well, okay, let's take an at will contract. And suppose Marathon wanted to hire someone and they came and tried to induce a worker that they thought was very industrious to quit and come to work for them. There's no social policy against that.
No, sir.
And it does go the other way, and you can articulate that based on this general trend of encouraging work, that you can tortiously interfere with an employer, but not at will contract, but not tortiously interfere with an employee.
Well, tortiously, and again with malice.
Well, that might tell be you what, this may be the best worker this subcontractor has, and they're starving him. The big, evil, national,
multinational company. And if he is the best worker and they hire him, they certainly aren't being malevolent to this worker's employee, which is, again, an element.
But to the worker's employer, they've hired an independent contractor to come. His employee is the best employee he's ever had, and they say, we need this guy to work in directly for us.
Sure.
To cut out the middleman.
Sure.
And you see no social policy there, but you do see it the other way.
I see it within the required element of malice, of a bad intent. There's nothing bad about offering a guy a better job.
Nothing bad about hiring an independent contractor and then wiping.
I would have concern if they were trying to destroy the employer and all they were doing is hiring this man at double his wages to get him away. That was the purpose. It was a malevolent purpose. But if they're simply hiring this man because he's done a good job, I do not see it.
Case by case, then you look at.
Yes, I would really encourage that because this one is a narrow case. For that reason, we would ask the Court of Appeals decision be reversed and the judgment for Mr. Stern be rendered. Thank you.
The Court is ready to hear an argument from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Ray Williams, with an argument for the respondent.
Please, Court, I have a couple of parts I'd like to use with the Court's permission.
The Do these reflect information that is in the record?
Yes, it does. One of them is just a summary of dates that was not actually introduced to trial. All the dates were introduced to trial.
All right.
If I could, what I'd like to do is back up and just briefly address the facts of this case that I think were a little unclear on this. Basically, Mr. Sterner's original lawsuit originated in 1975, which was a gas inhalation case. That case was not brought to trial until 1980. In the trial of that case, Mr. Sterner took the stand and related all of the prior injuries he had, along with the disabilities that he had from the gas inhalation back in 1975. The list of complaints that he referred to were: back in 1967, he had been shot and had partial paralysis of one of his arms, which restricted his climbing. And because of that, high pole rigging, which requires climbing, was taken off of the list of things which he could do in the union hall. He also related how he had a 50% disability to one of his knees from a high school injury and was required to miss 7.5 months worth of work because of that injury. He also had a knee injury to his other knee, along with a spine injury where he missed 3 months worth of work, and a disc injury where he had to miss another 2 months worth of work, also a broken hand, and he suffered from hypertension. He also, in the medical reports, these are all injuries that he had prior to the 1975 gas inhalation, which came out in the 1980 trial. In that trial, medical records were also introduced, which I'll show the court in just a moment, where one of the doctors had been told that he had a history of grand mal seizures. To make a long story short, Mr. Sterner took the stand in 1980, and his testimony was that he was incapacitated and unable to work, and that his situation had gotten so bad from the gas inhalation, in addition to all this, that he was unable to bowl. He couldn't walk a couple blocks without becoming short and out of breath.
How is it possibly relevant to the issue before the court? You obviously presented all this to the jury and this case alone. They weren't impressed. How did that relate to any legal issue before?
It relates because at the trial of that lawsuit in 1980, all of that information was being provided to the plant manager who was monitoring that trial to determine what was going on. When that case was tried, the information was conveyed to him daily. He kept a file. He testified in the trial of our lawsuit that he had the medical records, and he recalled the prior testimony, and when he was alerted that Mr. Sterner was back out on the premises, he went back to his file to double check to make sure that his information was correct and that he wasn't mistaken in what Mr. Sterner had testified to 9 months earlier. And because of that, he had the knowledge that this man was incapable of working, and that by Mr. Sterner's own admission that he could not work, coupled with all the prior injuries that he was complaining of. And that's why I think it's relevant as it goes to the Court of Appeals' opinion as to whether or not Marathon acted with just cause or not.
Well, I'm inclined to agree that there's some evidence of an excuse, but the question is there some evidence of no excuse?
I don't think there is, Judge.
Why doesn't the statement by the Marathon employee, not if I have anything to do about it, and coupled with the language on the pink slip the next day, why doesn't that raise an inference that Marathon directed Ford, Bacon, and Davis to fire this man?
That was a disputed issue as to why he was actually fired. The plant manager said that they simply asked that he be removed from the premises, not that he actually be terminated. As to why it was put on the slip like that, I don't know.
But if Marathon directed Ford, Bacon, and Davis to fire, would that be a tortious interference with the contract for which he could recover, putting aside for a moment the at-will question?
If you assume that they were not without just cause or excuse, and you ignore the case law as to whether or not that is a valid cause of action, if you assume that, it could be tortious interference.
No, let me make sure you understand my question. If the jury was convinced that Marathon directed Ford, Bacon, and Davis to fire, period,
whatever the reason, good reason, bad reason, doesn't make any difference. If that were the, if they were convinced that that happened, putting aside the at-will question, would that be, would that support recovery by the plaintiff?
I don't think so. I think you still have to add in the additional element of whether or not it was justified or excused.
What possible excuse is there for telling somebody's employer to fire?
Well, in looking at the cases to determine whether or not it's justified or excused, you have to use a balancing test as to whether or not you have an economic interest involved, your proprietary interest, those sort of things. At the time the work that was being conducted, Marathon was in the process of doing some $6 million worth of improvements. The testimony was from the project superintendent that extensive amounts of climbing were going to be required in the scope of that work. Mr. Sterner testified that he could not climb, and as a boilermaker, 75% of his work did require him to climb. The scenario that I see, coupled with the knowledge that the plant manager had from all the from the prior trial, is if they hadn't done anything. What if Mr. Sterner would have been climbing and gotten dizzy, dropped a wrench or something, and hit another worker? Then Marathon is going to be at fault because they have this knowledge which they hadn't acted on.
But how does that motivate Marathon to get him fired as opposed to get him off the job?
Because they are there, the plant manager testified that he has a duty to protect the health and welfare of everyone out there at that plant.
Yes, but he doesn't have a duty to protect the health and welfare of somebody else, somebody up to some other job, and if Ford Bacon and Davis wants to pull Mr. Sterner off and put him on another job, why couldn't they do that?
And that's our position, is that that's what we asked that they do. And that was a disputed issue at trial.
And but you lost. But you lost it before the jury. So the question is the no evidence, when we're looking for evidence to see whether or not the Court of Appeals is right,
okay,
are we looking for just evidence of telling him to be fired?
Assume that's what it is. Assume that did occur. It may show malice that they had ill will and spite toward him by doing that, assuming that's what it was. We deny that, but it still comes back to the greater issue that they had a superior proprietary interest to protect, coupled with the knowledge from the prior trials, which was only 9 months earlier. And I get back to the questions that you were asking earlier. I still think that they have the right as a property owner to do what they did.
Ford Bacon and Davis did have other jobs going on.
I don't know. I don't know.
But the record will show whether or not every employee they have this full-time engaged on this particular.
I think so. Our position simply is, it pertains to the issue of the way it was submitted and whether or not that was incorrect. The Court of Appeals was guided by the Poole versus Ford Motor Company as to whether or not they could unfind a fact or not. In this case, this court has recently found in Cropper versus Caterpillar Tractor Company, which is at 754-646, that whether or not you have a yes or no answer to an issue, that the distinction between a finding and an unfinding by the court has been abolished and that the court is free to do that. And as to whether or not the court applied the proper standard in finding no evidence, we submit that they did by following the Supreme Court case.
Proper is purely a sufficiency. I mean, that's a minor point.
I agree with you.
Always has the right, if there's no evidence to support a verdict, to reverse and render it, as we did here.
I agree with you.
Poole and Proper are remand cases.
I would go further to state that the Court of Appeals found as a matter of law that Marathon did act with justification in their actions.
Isn't that substituting their judgment for that of the jury?
That's the argument that's being made, and that's where you have to apply the test to see if they followed the proper standard by disregarding all the evidence to support the issues that were submitted. And we submit that they did by following the King versus Bauer case, that they did do that.
One issue we've talked about this morning is whether the burden on without justification or excuse ought to be on the plaintiff or the defendant. What's your view of that?
Obviously, it was submitted on us in this particular case. If you read Sackwich versus Steck, and there's a subsequent case after that, whereby the issue has been, there is some confusion as to how it should be submitted. And I think, in all honesty, I'd have to say that as a defense, it should be submitted as a defense.
And if you take on that burden and you lose, why should you get another bite at the apple?
Well, if as pertains to this particular case, Mr. Davenport said that he doesn't want to say it's a blacklisting case, but that's what it was argued at the time of the trial. And I think the jury was so misguided as to render a manifestly unjust verdict by the outcome. And I don't think there was any evidence of support that Marathon did anything wrong. That when you couple it with, to me, it's a case where a man ought to be bound by his testimony that he's incapable of working. Obviously, the jury didn't see it that way, but when a man gets up there and testifies the way he did, I find it hard to believe that Marathon wasn't justified in doing what they did.
You're not attacking me, the general propositions of the plan, then, that under some circumstances, Marathon could interfere with this contract, even though it was an at-will employment, could take some actions which would be malicious and would give rise to a tort claim by this terminated employee or contractor.
The cases are such that you can still have malice, but if it's justified or excused, it takes out one of the
elements. So your argument is purely evidentiary. We're not talking about any grand scheme of the law here.
That's right.
It's just the record in this case.
That's correct.
Well, we disagree with you and feel like there's some evidence to support the jury verdict. Do we have to remand it to the Court of Appeals, or do we reverse and render?
I think that you have to remand it to the Court of Appeals. Appeals.
That's an insufficiency point that they've not ruled on?
No, sir.
Well, then why would...
You didn't have insufficiency points in the court?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir, I did.
You preserved it.
Right.
If the court found some evidence.
Right, I did. And I go back to what the court is saying, Justice Phillips, with regard to whether or not if there's malice. The Court of Appeals found that the evidence, whether or not they terminated Sterner by Ford, Bacon, and Davis, that may be some evidence that there was malice and that they had ill will and bad feelings towards Mr. Sterner. But they said that was no evidence as to whether or not they were justified and excused in their actions. That's the distinction that's got to be made. They might have had ill will, but the court still found that they were justified in what they did.
And you don't see any, you don't follow the distinction Justice Hecht has made between their concern for giving Ford, Davis, and Bacon full knowledge of what they knew and their concern for the safety of their other employees and getting somebody fired entirely.
Let me make sure I'm clear on what you're asking, but are you saying that maybe Marathon should have gone to Ford, Bacon, and Davis and told them?
We don't want this man out here
on our job.
I understand.
You can put him on any other job you want to, or give him a job where he's set, you know, where he won't be subject to having the problems because of the limitations that we know about.
I still come back to the position that knowing that having that knowledge that they are bound by it, and if another man got work injured from some actions of Sterner, whether he got dizzy and fell and hit someone else, Marathon could still be liable for third-party claims. And it's still a disputed issue as to what exactly they told him with regard to his termination. Our position is they told him simply to put him on another job, and that they're not terminating.
But there's some evidence in this record of a more, shall we say, global state in peace with itself.
That's correct. I can't dispute that at this point. But I still go back to that goes to the malice issue, and not whether or not they had just cause or excuse.
Well, when I started, I wasn't asking about malice. I was just asking about justification. Where is the limit to that justification?
I think
to extend only to your workplace or to the world.
I think as a property owner, you have to look out for anyone who comes onto your premises. And coupled with the knowledge that they had from Mr. Turner himself, they were bound by that knowledge and act upon it.
Well, the real question is, did they go too far?
I certainly don't think so.
I don't mean to keep reiterating the facts, but I mean, he said he couldn't climb. And his testimony was that this job was going to require extensive climbing, that he had partial paralysis, he was dizzy, he had seizures, all of that evidence.
Let me make it a little worse, counsel. Suppose that they,
I try to agree, you know, I'll
suppose they said, suppose they went to Ford, Bacon, and Davis and said, we are concerned about this man Stern, and we're afraid for his health and the lives of the rest of the people that he may come into contact with, and even though he sued us and recovered a big judgment, we don't want anything bad to happen to him. But he can't do this work. He ought not to be doing this work in your employment, and if you want to stay on our job, fire. If they had said that, would that be tortious interference with contract?
That I think it would, but that is not the fact. They never, there's no evidence that they ever told Ford, Bacon, and Davis that they were going to terminate them from the job if they didn't get rid of it.
But the reason I ask it that way is because whether Marathon was motivated out of malice against Mr. Stirner or out of the most the greatest beneficence and charity they might have had is really irrelevant, isn't the question whether they willfully sought to have him terminated without justification.
It's, you got to split up the elements. Was there malice?
And is malice an element?
Yes, it is. That is an element. And that's what I keep coming back to, is the court said, yes, that wrong, the termination slip might have been evidence of malice and their ill feelings towards him. But they come back and said that is no evidence that they were not justified in their actions. And the malice issue was submitted to, as part of the cause of action, you know, and the requirement in the statute that it be included in there.
What did the jury find with regards to malice?
Found that, yes, sir.
They had malice?
Yes, sir.
What did they find about justification?
Found that there was no justification.
You were not justified.
That's correct. That's correct.
And why is it when the Court of Appeals turned it around, why is it not that the Court of Appeals substituted their judgment on this issue to the jury?
Why did they do that?
No. Why is it not a plausible argument that all the Court of Appeals did with regards to that issue of justification, and they substituted their judgment with that of the jury?
Okay, because they went back and they, in order to do that, the Court of Appeals can find as a matter of law that they were justified. And that's our position, that they did find as a matter of law that they were justified. The Poole case, in order to do that, you have to go back and use all the inferences and evidence that favors the findings of the trial court, which they did. And if you're going to do that, you have to go back and specifically list in your opinion why that evidence that is not sufficient as a matter of law or insufficient evidence. The Court of Appeals did that. And that's where I keep coming back. They said the wrongful termination, yes, that may be some evidence of malice, but it is no evidence as pertains to the issue of just cause.
I don't understand that statement. You've made it now four or five times.
I may be unclear on it, and I'll try
to... Say it again for me one more time. Just
okay.
What I just said in the last sentence.
In a tortious interference case, you have to have... one of the issues is malice, and then one of the issues are defenses, however the court's going to submit it under staff for the older cases, is you can still have malice. But if you have justification or excuse, your tortious interference claim goes out the window.
And that's a law question?
Yes. Well, no, it's an issue to be decided by the jury, obviously.
Well, but you just stated it a while ago, this is a law question.
I'm saying the Court of Appeals can find it as a matter of law on appeal if the evidence if they go back and examine the record and determine that there's no evidence to support the finding by the jury, they can find that as a matter of law. But yes, it is submitted as an issue of fact for the jury, but I'm saying, and the court found that as a matter of law that they were justified and excused. They're saying there may have still been malice, but that's no evidence that they weren't justified or excused. Does that help at all? Am I still unclear on what I'm trying to say?
They can be malicious, but they can have good reason for being malicious, and that's okay.
Basically, that's right.
Does converse that hold true also?
Can you have just cause?
No, that the jury finds that it was justified, and the Court of Appeals can hold as a matter of law that it wasn't.
I think, sure, if the evidence justifies it. And that's basically what the court has said.
I agree with you. It's much more symmetrical that way. If it works one way, it ought to work both.
Well, as I understand it, any issue that's submitted in any trial of a case, the court can come back, and that's what we come back to, is unfinding an issue. They can find it as a matter of law that the jury was wrong. And in essence, I guess you're going to come back to substituting their finding. But to do that, you have to track the Poole versus Ford Motor case to do it. And make sure that all the evidence that would support the verdict is looked at, and any evidence contrary to the verdict is thrown out. And that's what the court did. They said, yes, Marathon, you might have been malicious, but you did have just cause in your actions.
And that there was no evidence to the contrary.
That's correct. And just so I'm clear on the termination slip, that's the court specifically addressed that, and that's what they said. Yes, that may have been malicious to do that. But that termination slip was no evidence as to whether or not they acted without just cause or excuse.
That's an incredible statement. The reason they get on the termination slip is no evidence as to why they fired him.
It said that is some evidence as to malice. The Court of Appeals
had no evidence as to why they fired him.
No evidence as to them not having an excuse for doing what they did or having
what
just cause.
What I just said, why they fired him.
Right.
That's the same thing.
I think it comes back to you can have malice but still have a good excuse to do it.
The termination slip was evidence as to malice, but that bears no relationship to having just cause for his termination. Is that correct?
If you follow what the Court of Appeals did in using all the evidence favorable and all the inferences to the benefit of the jury findings, that's correct.
I understand.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Good explanation.
But this question of excuse is something that you assumed as affirmative defense?
Yes, I did, the way the issue was submitted.
And so if you didn't get a finding on your affirmative defense, where does that leave us?
If I didn't get a finding on the affirmative defense...
It means you didn't carry your burden.
Exactly.
You didn't persuade the jury.
Exactly. And
we said improper that the Court of Appeals and turn that around, didn't it?
Well, we're not... Poole is not relevant. Crawford is not relevant. This is a no evidence on in this case, an affirmative defense established as a matter of law, which is a different thing now. In the event this case were remanded, then we have to go through that drill.
Well, I would also refer the court to the 1983 Supreme Court opinion, Croucher versus Croucher, which is cited 660 Southwest 2nd 55. And in essence, the court found there that a complaint by the party with the burden of proof that there was no evidence to support the jury's findings invoked appellate jurisdiction to consider the contention that the opposite of the finding was established as a matter of law. And that is what I'm saying with regard to the just cause and excuse issue. And the Court of Appeals again said you might have been malicious, but you were still justified and excused in your actions.
It seems kind of hard to rationalize that you couldn't persuade the jury that you were right, but you were able to persuade the Court of Appeals.
Well, I've got my corporate counsel over there, and she asked me the same thing, so I don't know if I did that bad a job with the facts or what, but it was definitely a surprise to me. And so
maybe
anyway.
Three are just easier to convince than 12.
I don't know. Yeah. But I think that the jury was misled by turning the case into a blacklisting case. It was not a blacklisting case.
But you don't have evidentiary objections on that up here.
Well, we objected at the time of trial.
But that's not before this court.
No.
So you're just giving us a kind of side excuse.
No. Well, for purposes of the testimony from the Ford, Bacon, and Davis employee, that testimony came out that, yes, it was blacklisting, and then on cross he says, no, it wasn't really blacklisting. There's just a list of people who aren't supposed to be out there. And that's where this blacklisting arose from.
Gray listing.
Yeah. Are there any more questions as pertains to the separation between malice and the just cause or excuse?
We're all going to have to look at it.
Okay.
It's kind of like angels dancing on the head of a pin, isn't it? I mean, that's not an immediate apparent. When somebody gets a fact that you can put it in one category or the other.
It's simply one of the elements of the cause of action for tortious interference. And if you knock one of them out, you don't prevail.
Well, I agree with that.
And that's what it boils down to.
Separating, taking a piece of evidence and deciding which one of those two slots it falls into, it takes some work, some mental gyrations.
Are there any other questions?
I
must say that I agree with the first gentleman who argued their case that they were excited to be here for the first time, and I've done that before. But after coming back a second time, I think it's almost cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, I wanted to earn your fee.
I appreciate y'all's consideration.
Thank you, Jim.
I do not want my client accusing me of helping out the other side, but in the interest of kind of maintaining some purity of the law, I think one thing that would be helpful in this case, and those with a business background can provide some input. The cases are getting confused between two causes of action. There's a tortious interference with a business relationship cause of action. And if you look at, I think, section 769 of restatements, that discusses that. In that case, you do not have to have a contract, but you do have to have malice, malice being defined as ill will, motive, etc. That, in fact, Prosser is referred to that. He discusses that. And it's interference with prospective gain. And I've seen that confusion because I've seen them cite 769 in their brief, which is not applicable, and I think there's the Davis versus Lewis case, which is discussed in their brief, where the body shop didn't get the contract to repair the car. There never was the contract gotten. And there's a discussion in the brief about the tip-off. You can see it comes with confusion coming sometimes when it says tortious interference with the contractual relationship. And technically, the better way to refer to it is tortious interference with the contract, period, versus interference with the business relationship. On the other hand, this case is tortious interference with a contract, period. You have to prove contract. Now, some of the cases talk about malice. But then they say malice in this case is defined as interference without legal justification or excuse. And that's where part of the confusion comes in. I think it's like Alice in Wonderland. I think there's some character in there that says the word means what I want it to mean. You see the word malice used in decisions, but it means different things depending upon the cause of action.
So in this case, even if Marathon very strongly disliked Mr. Sterner and it was purely personal and malicious and they wished him ill and hoped the worst for him, they could still have acted in the interests of their property by telling Ford, Bacon, and Davis that he stay off the property, but your position is they didn't do that.
Correct. I mean, I knew I potentially was walking myself into a problem by explaining this distinction by saying he didn't have to show ill will. But again, I say the distinction, this is what concerned me. Justice Cook talked about having just cause or having legal justification or excuse. If you will look at the definition of the special issue in this case, I think the charge starts on page 111 of the transcript. The jury is told it's the exercise of the legal justification or excuse. Or there are prior cases talk about the bona fide exercise. So I say this case is winnable and distinguishable by virtue of the fact that even though they might have had, on some other terms, legal excuse or justification, the jury did not buy their argument that they were exercising in bona fide good faith that legal justification. The jury just didn't believe them. And that's what's key. It's not just the existence of it. It's the exercise of it, the bona fide exercise. In this case, they had the burden of proof, and the jury just didn't buy it. And that's why when they start discussing these maladies, I say, fine, I agree with you. I concede. He might have had every one of those problems, but that's not what the jury believed was their motivation for going and getting him fired. And they decided to take on the burden of proof in this case. It's also important, as a technical matter in this case, we do talk about no evidence. And I put that on the same side of the fence as the insufficiency of the evidence. But what has occurred in order for them to prevail in this case is not a question of no evidence or insufficiency. It must be that the opposite proposition was established either one, as a matter of law, or two, that the evidence was so overwhelming. We still have legal and factual fact questions, but one is an insufficiency and one is establishing the opposite proposition. In this case, they took on the burden. And even if I hadn't put forth what I believe to be the true reason for them seeing that it was fired, but I did, thinking that I was going to have the burden of proof up until the end, the jury was entitled to not hear from me, to hear from them, and just not believe what they said.
But in order for them to win, the Court of Appeals has to say that the trial judge should have properly directed a verdict
based upon
their affirmative defense at the close of all the evidence, not the close of your evidence, but since it was affirmative defense after the defendant raised it.
Yes, sir.
That we've established our affirmative defense as a matter of law.
As a matter of law. And that requires them to believe their people. And I will give you an example. Their plant manager on page 92 of the statement of facts testifies in response to one of my questions, "I'm not trying to trick you. You said he was not prohibited from going out there. You have answered earlier." The plant manager says, "Yes. If the job was to be done, did not ask of Mr. Sterner to do those kinds of things which he said he was capable of, then we wouldn't have a problem." I mean, they tried to take the position in this case of sliding into the excuse of we're just preventing him from doing the job. But the fact of the matter is, Johnny Burks, the one person who didn't have an interest in this case, in fact, we put on through deposition testimony after we found him, I think, in Alabama, and he was semi-hostile, said he was prevented from going on that plant premise for any reason at any time. So the jury was entitled to listen to their people and just say, "There's a conflict, and we don't believe you, and you haven't carried your burden of proof." For that reason, we think the jury's verdict ought to stand. We would pray that the verdict of the judgment of the trial court be affirmed by reversing the
court. Well, we have to reverse from the mass of the court of appeals for the sufficient point, and have not ruled on. Not
the problem, I hear what you're saying, there is a problem in that respect because they did the same thing on the insufficiency point that they did on the no evidence point. There's a final paragraph in their opinion, quite frankly, that says, "And if called upon to determine the sufficiency of the evidence, we would say that the evidence was insufficient."
But so they haven't said it yet. They just said they will say it.
Yes, sir.
That means you'll lose.
Well, not if they are corrected and shown that it's not a factual insufficiency, it's going to be a factual overwhelming. I mean, again, they have to...
So get a retry.
They did not use the proper word.
They didn't even... Yes, that's correct. They did not even use the proper wording on what they would do if it came back to it. They would have to say, not insufficiency, they would have to say, if it comes back to us, we will decide that it was established by overwhelming weight of the evidence.
Any questions?
So at the conclusion of your opening argument today, you said you wanted this case reversed and rendered. Is there a basis for doing that?
With that in mind, I think I do not have support for saying it ought to be rendered, quite frankly, Judge Doggett. If it comes down to it, I think it ought to be, if the narrow issues are addressed like they are, it will come back to, I guess, whether they have, the court again wants to say it was overwhelmingly established. And in that case, it would be a remand. But.
Thank you, sir. Court will take another brief recess.
May I ask the court for 2 weeks to file a supplemental brief to try and clear up our position?
We can get it in 10 days.
That's fine.
I know we got another 2 weeks, but until he had a trial. All right. If you want to respond,
find it out.
Yeah.